Styles was bored by Archie and Agatha together. His income was obviously more stable than hers, although she was earning quite well. The suggestion had been made that Agatha had become possessive about her own money, spending it on herself and her blood relations, rather than sharing it with her husband. But even if that were true, which it was in the case of Monty, what would it mean? Men supported the home in the 1920s. Archie would not have expected to do otherwise, and would certainly not have wanted money from his wife, unless in real need of it. Nevertheless, it is true that Agatha's earnings were giving her the appearance of an independent being. The Christies shared a home and a child, but in other ways, their lives had become quite separate. Archie had his golf and his city friends like Sam James, a smiling, successful businessman who lived with his wife Madge at Hurtmore, near Godalming. Agatha had Nan, Carlo, her family. Archie loved to stay where he was. Agatha yearned to travel again. In 1925, they went on holiday together at Courtauld in the Pyrenees, where she had stayed as a child with her parents. Happy memories had made her want to return. No doubt the shadow of Agatha's family cast itself upon Archie's willingness to enjoy himself, and he did not especially do so. As on board ship during the Empire tour, he went to bed at 10:30, while Agatha stayed up, watching the music hall show at the Kursaal, her mind half on her husband. The next year, she wanted to go away again, but Archie did not. So she went with her sister for a short break to Corsica. Her relationship with Madge was not perfect, but there was a level of understanding between them that Agatha craved. They could talk together about the past, about Monty, about their parents. They could share the delight in life they had both felt before marriage, motherhood, and housekeeping had claimed them. They could alleviate each other's concerns about Clara, whose health had been precarious for some time now. The first months of 1926 were crammed and exhausting for Agatha. She was moving to Styles with her family, she was buying a first home with her husband, she was awaiting the publication in May of The Murder of Roger Ackroyd, and all the time her heart was with her mother at Ashfield. Clara had written in February, her hand by this time somewhat wild but still firm. "The coat is lovely, just right. I did not expect to live to wear it, but I think I shall now. The worst is over, and my heart is getting still down. I took off nighty today and put on clothes and dressing gown, yours. Both windows wide open, no fire, and the sun streaming in. Such a hot, glorious day. I have really had a beautiful birthday. Miss Butler went in motorboat to Brixham and was very happy. I have asked her to stay for the present, and she seemed very pleased about it. I'm still too weak to bother about getting a gardener, and she is doing the garden very well. My firm love and devotion to Archie and Rosalind." And instantly, Agatha was transported back to childhood. The windows pushing open the taut smell of the sea, the boat to Brixham along the coast from Torquay, the cry of gulls scratching the sky, the garden at Ashfield. She had a yearning to go back. A yearning to escape. On her return from Corsica, she went down to stay with her mother. Clara had contracted bronchitis. Her mother looked so small and pathetic, and she was so lonely in that big house. But Ashfield still sang its siren lure. The border needed tending, and the rooms had become shabbier. It made not a whit of difference to Agatha, who loved this house and the kind, clever woman in it, with an inappropriate and indestructible passion. Clara kept to just two rooms now, where she and Agatha talked together like the mother and daughter in Unfinished Portrait. Miriam tells Celia that she seems happy. "I want you so much to be happy, my darling." She also tells her that she has been wrong about Dermot. "I've been jealous. I haven't been willing to recognize his good qualities." Then she says, "Don't ever leave your husband too long alone, Celia. Remember, a man forgets." So Agatha returned to Archie and the dark house at Sunningdale. Madge took her place at Ashfield, and at the end of March brought their mother home to Abney. Again Clara kept to her room, but she seemed over the worst. "Darling Agatha, going on about the same. A little better, I think. Lovely weather here, and I expect you are all sitting in the garden, and Peter digging. The precious naughty one. My love to Rosalind." "Did you back Jack Horner?" she wrote, in a reference to the 1926 Grand National winner. She died on the 5th of April, soon after this letter was sent, while Agatha was on the train to visit her at Abney. In her autobiography, Agatha wrote that her mother had longed to be free of the prison of her aging body, and that she herself had felt Clara's sense of release. Her tone is sad, reasonable, resigned. Unfinished Portrait came closer to the truth of that time. Agatha writes of her little gallant mother, whom all her life she had found wonderful and satisfying, and now her mother had gone. The bottom had fallen out of Celia's world. Even this, though, does not begin to express the unbearable sense of loss. It was quite literally beyond words. That is why every sentence ends with ellipses. There are no words with which to end the sentence. For Archie, Agatha felt the love of a woman for a man. She loved him passionately and occasionally to distraction. However much the comfortable appearance of middle age shrouded her emotions, they were there still, burning inside her. But Clara had been the love of her life. It was Clara who had laid Agatha's heart bare with her courage, her earnestness, her indomitable spark. The thought of her mother alone at Ashfield, her spectacles slipping from her nose as she fell asleep over Dickens in front of the fire, had aroused in Agatha all the sweet, poignant, tender emotions that probably should have gone towards her child, that kept her childlike. "Lots and lots and lots of love, my precious mummy." Without Clara, she was like Joan Scudamore in Absent in the Spring, alone in the desert and unsuccoured. How would she live without the knowledge that whatever happened, she could go to Ashfield and be with her mother? That exquisite relaxation, that sense of sinking into soft familiarity, that perfect smiling communion. Her mother's hand in hers, her luminous gaze, which saw Agatha as she was, and thought what she saw quite perfect. How lovely to be at home. Celia loved the feeling of stepping back into her old life, to feel the happy tide of reassurance sweeping over her, the feeling of being loved. It was so restful to be yourself. Oh, dear home. What was home now? Was it the dark prison of Styles, where Agatha must try to be for Rosalind? Cool-eyed Rosalind, the person that Clara had been for her? Or was it still Ashfield, where memory bloomed in the empty rooms like rose scent? Agatha clung to the thought of Archie's return from Spain, where he was on business. He knew how she had loved her mother. He would hold her. He would fill some of the terrible space inside and around her in this shadowy house. Rosalind was useless. Although she had been sad about her grandmother, she was too young and self-possessed to give sympathy. Carlo gave it, in her dignified way. So did Peter the dog, whose eyes seemed to shine with the same understanding that Clara had once bent upon Agatha. She clung to him, as his warm, woolly body held all the love in the world. "My little friend and loving companion in affliction," she later called him. It was Archie, though, whom Agatha needed. Her man, her love. Like a drowning person, she held to the thought of him as she put on her black clothes and stood frozen at Clara's graveside. Belief in God was a theoretical consolation. Clara would have felt that she was now with her Maker. But this did almost nothing to help the 35-year-old woman who simply wanted her mother. She wanted Clara to make it better, as she had done 30 years earlier, when Agatha had cried silently all the way home from the day trip in France, and Clara had said, looking at her daughter, "I believe she doesn't like the butterfly in her hat." Then Archie came home. The sound of him entering the hall at Styles was beautiful to Agatha. "Now do I surely know what I shall awake, return once more to love and delight." Now she would no longer be alone. she would be understood and cared for. Agatha had forgotten her husband's nature. He had always hated illness and distress. It disarmed him, and now in his embarrassment he assumed an air of jollity. "Everything all right? Not yet? Ah, well, time heals." He suggested that Agatha come back with him to Spain, where he had more business to transact. It would take her mind off things. How about it? She reacted with horror. It was as if he were asking her to abandon her mother, which in a way he was. The jealousy he had felt for Clara in life was still there. Agatha's grief was excessive, unseemly. Would she have been reduced to such a state for him? He had made his offer of a holiday the best thing he could think of. There was, he felt, nothing more he could do for his wife. In the end, Celia went to sleep holding his hand, which he withdrew with relief when he saw she was really asleep. Later, Agatha wrote of how wrongly she felt she had behaved towards her husband. "My life with Archie lay ahead of me. We were happy together, assured of each other, and neither of us would have dreamed that we could ever part." She should have gone with him to Spain and dealt with Ashfield, which was now her property and needed cleaning and sorting on her return. She should have recognized the nature of the man she loved. "My mother left my father alone," said Rosalind. "Granny always said, don't leave a man alone." So Archie went to Spain, and Agatha went with Rosalind to Torquay to clear her family possessions. The estate, such as it was, had to be settled, and a decision made as to whether to sell Ashfield. It was arranged that Stiles would be let, not least because the money was needed. Archie could stay at his club in London, and then, when Agatha had finished her task, the Christies would take a holiday together in Italy. This was something to look forward to. Again, it was a thought to which Agatha clung. The smell of Ashfield was the same, within the smell of damp and decay. The roof was falling in, water was dripping through the ceilings. It was a sad house now, although every cupboard held a memory of happiness. "No man ever had a wife like you," read the letter that Frederick had written to Clara shortly before his death. In one of the drawers was the purse Clara had embroidered with the entwined initials F and C, and the line, "Set me as a seal upon thine heart, for love is strong as death." There was the letter to Agatha from Clara. "Darling little girlie, mother is longing to kiss and love her sweet pea again. Auntie Granny sends you much love. Tell Jane to please get a partridge to make you some potted meat for tea or breakfast." And from Frederick, "I hear your granny is going to have your picture painted. I think it is a most lovely idea, and I want you to put your little arms around Granny's neck and give her a hug and kiss for me. You must always be good and gentle to her, and I am pleased to think you are." These things were like dead flowers, like the edelweiss Clara had kept from her honeymoon in Switzerland. As they were uncovered, the faint scent of love arose and grew strong again. The house had become almost like an immense storeroom, with all but the two rooms Clara used crammed with furniture, trunks, books, cases. Margaret Miller's possessions were also there, transported when she moved from Ealing. In her old home, Margaret had wept as her life was unearthed around her. A moth-eaten velvet dress from Madame Poncerot's, lengths of silk from the army and navy stores, print for servants' dresses, a clothes basket full of weaverly flour, 36 demijohns of homemade liquor, 5 of which had been stolen by the removal men to Margaret's flattered delight, packets of sugar and butter stored for future Christmases, which would never now be eaten, letters, papers, an old envelope full of 5-pound notes. Margaret followed her own advice. A diamond brooch slung inside a stocking. A wax wreath memorial to Nathaniel Miller. Such were the things Agatha now had to go through. It is beyond endurance, the continued life of things, when the owner of those things is dead. So it was with Clara's clothes, bought with busy plans for when they would be worn, or the album of confessions filled in with a 17-year-old's solemn concentration. The humble accretions of a life. At some lost moment, every one of these things had been the most important thing in the world to Clara. Perhaps it would have been better, as Archie had suggested, to burn them at once. Peter bent his friendly eyes upon Agatha as she pulled out dress after dress from her mother's wardrobe. He wagged his wiry tail every time she moved, and was at her heels as she made incessant trips up and down stairs with boxes of hats, clothes, books. He may even have been slightly annoying in his relentless determination to stick with her, but he would not be deterred. Meanwhile, Rosalind helped her mother to carry boxes in between playing in the garden. Agatha felt she should keep her grief away from her daughter, and tried much of the time to suppress it. Only the dog saw its manifestations. Agatha worked through Ashfield with the intensity of a woman possessed, as she was in a sense. One maid helped her in the morning, another in the afternoon, but the work went on and on. Madge could not leave Abney until August. Carlo would have been a consoling presence, but she had her own concerns. She had been recalled to Edinburgh, where her father was believed to be dying, but at least she would be by his side. The weeks passed, solitary and strange. Roger Ackroyd was published. Summer bloomed in the garden. The warmth and light grew outside as Agatha sat in the house among her family's things, burying herself deeper in her past, which lay around her in heaps like earth. "To have been so happy and not to have known it," she wrote in the hollow, when her character Henrietta thinks of the house she had loved as a child. "If I could go back." "One can't go back," says Henrietta. "That's the one thing one can't do. Go back." And soon, Archie would be there, just before Rosalind's 7th birthday on 5th of August, and then they would go on holiday together to Italy. Summer. And love. She was slim again, as he liked her to be, although she was also worn and tired because she was unable to eat despite the physical work she was doing. Sometimes she was not quite sure what she was doing. Would she sell the house? Would she let it? Would she ever be finished? She could do nothing with Ashfield until she had cleared every room, some of which had been locked up for years. "Still, another 6 weeks or so, and I would get it all finished," she wrote in her autobiography. "Then I could begin to live again." She collapsed in uncontrollable sobs one day when she was unable to start her car. "That worried me." She also worried that Archie did not come to Ashfield for an occasional weekend, despite the fact that she could not visit him at his London club, as she had nobody to look after Rosalind. He said he was helping in the general strike, and that anyway, it was a waste of money, as they would see each other soon. It occurred to her that he did not want to miss his golf. The thought upset her, so she tried to dismiss it. She heard Clara's voice telling her that Archie could be ruthless. Celia thought, "He's not kind. He's not." A great wave of loneliness passed over her. She felt afraid. How cold the world was, without her mother. But then there were the memories of Archie at Ashfield, infinitely lovely and precious, chugging up Barton Road on his motorbike, rising from his chair in the drawing room when she had tripped home from Rooklands across the road, turning to her in the schoolroom upstairs saying, "You've got to marry me, you've got to marry me." Walking hand in hand with her in the garden before Rosalind was born, kissing her beneath the summer night sky before the nurse called and she went back into the house. Almost to the day, it was 7 years since that night when Archie returned to Ashfield. Madge had arrived already. She was to look after Rosalind during the Italian holiday, and her presence had lifted some of the blight from Agatha, who was wrapping her daughter's birthday presents when Archie came into the house. As soon as she saw him, she knew something was wrong. It was as if somebody else inhabited his body and looked out through his eyes. He was the gunman of Agatha's childhood nightmare who came to Ashfield in the guise of a beloved person, but, as became apparent, was a stranger filled with murderous intent. Archie seems very queer. Is he ill or something? Madge asked her sister. Perhaps, thought Agatha, that was it. Perhaps it was cancer, even. Or perhaps there was a problem at work, something to do with money. Because he looked almost criminal in his shiftiness. It was none of these things. Archie told Agatha that he had done nothing about organizing the holiday in Italy. She said it didn't matter. It would be just as nice to stay in England. No, that wasn't the point. You know that dark girl who used to be Belcher's secretary? We had her down for a weekend once, a year ago, with Belcher, and we've seen her in London once or twice. Agatha could not remember the dark girl's name, although she knew whom he meant. Nancy Neal. Well, during his summer alone in London, he had seen rather a lot of her. Well, said Agatha, why shouldn't you? She felt such relief that it was not cancer, not embezzlement, not something that would threaten her future with Archie. Just a flirtation. Not the sort of thing she would have expected from her serious-minded husband, in whom she had always placed complete trust. Dermot never looks at anything but a golf ball. But then her grandmother would have reminded her that any man was capable of that sort of thing, particularly if he was left alone. How right Margaret had been. And how awful of him, really, to flirt with that girl while his wife of 12 years was going through such hell. But of course, he had never been able to stand illness or unhappiness. She would forgive him for his silliness. He was the silly one this time. He was still talking, sounding impatient, and guilty about being impatient. He was saying things that could not be believed. You still don't understand. I've fallen in love with her, and I want a divorce as soon as possible. As Agatha asked him to do, Archie stayed at Ashfield for Rosalind's birthday, so that it should not be spoiled for her. The next day, he went back to his club, and, not long afterwards, his wife and daughter returned to Stiles. Carlo's father was less seriously ill than had been feared. In response to Agatha's distress, she came back from Edinburgh, and her stalwart presence made the days a little easier. At night, only Peter brought comfort. Sleep did not come for Agatha, who wandered through the corridors of the black and terrible house, crying for her mother. Love passes out into the silent night. We may not hold him who has served our will. And for a while made magic common things. Now, like a bird, he spreads his wings in flight. And we are left in darkness, listening still to the faint, far-off beating of his wings. The poem Love Passes was in the Road of Dreams collection. As this was published in 1924, the possibility that Archie was no longer in love with her may have occurred to Agatha some time earlier, before he had even met Nancy. She may have thought that she, too, had fallen out of love. Of course, the poem is not a factual record, although outside her detective fiction, and occasionally within it, Agatha wrote from the heart. Love passes. On the heart dead embers lie. Where once there burned a fire of living flame, where we, starved children, sheltering in shame, stretched out our hands and let the world go by. The truth is that Agatha was playing with her very real emotions, pushing her fear to the point of exorcism, to the point where she no longer believed it. She must have been thinking these things, in however deep a part of herself. For all her obtuseness, something in her had sensed change. While she was bringing life to the merry love affairs in The Man in the Brown Suit and The Secret of Chimneys, those ecstatic pairings between the Archie she wanted and the Agatha she wanted to be, she was also writing her own future in poems like Love Passes and Progression. Springtime will come again. The almond trees blossom once more. And yet I weep, for never again shall I tread love's way with you. Farewell, O lover of mine. Our day is done. But she did not really think that the Christie's day was done. She had played with fear in her art, in a way that was almost a luxury, until the moment the truth came out of Archie's mouth. Agatha knew Nancy Neal. She quite liked her. Nancy was 26, still living at home with her parents in Hertfordshire, working as a secretary in the city. Her great friend Madge Fox, with whom she had trained at the Triangle Secretarial School in South Moulton Street, later married Archie's friend Sam James. Thus Nancy had come into Archie Christie's orbit. At some point in 1925, she stayed a weekend at Hurdmore Cottage, the James home near Godalming, and found Archie there alone. He needed a golf partner, as Sam did not play. Nancy did, rather well. In the course of things, she came to know Agatha, who chaperoned her at a dance, and asked her to stay at Styles for a weekend. It seems, although there is no absolute proof of this, that Nancy accepted at least one invitation. According to the autobiography, Archie objected to my asking her down to stay. He said it would spoil his golf, which was, of course, a remark that could be interpreted in two very different ways. Agatha took the view that this meant he had had no particular interest in Nancy until after April 1926. At that point, he was left alone in London. He did not wish to visit his wife at Ashfield because he could not cope with her uncontrolled grief. His boredom and solitude had driven him into Nancy's arms. As Agatha put it, her own absence left him open to other influences. This was the view also held by Rosalind, whose loyalty to her father was staunch. He wasn't that kind of man. They'd been married a long time, but my mother went away. Naturally, he wanted someone to play with, play golf with.
"Well, that's a generous interpretation," says Rosalind's half-brother, Archie. Because the more cynical view, of course, is that Archie Christie did not want Nancy Neal at Styles because he had an interest, to say the least, in her, and would have found it both embarrassing and distasteful for his wife to receive her at their marital home. There is no way of knowing exactly when Archie fell in love with Nancy. Neither is there any proof that they had an affair. Indeed, Madge James was absolutely adamant that Nancy was never Archie's mistress, writing in a letter in the 1980s that, in those days, we did not pop into bed at the drop of a hat, as they do today. I was Nancy's most intimate friend, and I am prepared to swear that nothing of this occurred. Another source states that the affair had been going on and off for 18 months before Archie visited Ashfield in August 1926. But this information is at three removes, coming as it does from Judith, daughter of Agatha's friend, Nan Conn. It assumes that Archie told the details of his affair to Agatha, who then relayed them to Nan, both of which are unlikely in the extreme, and that Nan repeated every single detail to her daughter, who was only 10 at the time of these events. Judith's account states this timetable. Archie was sleeping with Nancy from the time he met her in early 1925. In the summer, he went to Courtauld with Agatha, having broken off the affair. On his return from the holiday, he resumed with Nancy and led a double life until August 1926. His obsession with playing golf was, in fact, an excuse to be with his mistress. His weekends were for her and her alone, and the Jameses, who knew that he was unhappy with Agatha, provided a useful bolt hole at Godalming. Archie refused to go to Corsica with Agatha because he wanted to be with Nancy. During his months alone in London after Clara's death, he took the opportunity to consolidate the relationship. Such a version of events is completely uncorroborated and cannot possibly be taken as fact. Nevertheless, Nan Conn might have known something. She was on the Sunningdale scene, and her husband George was a friend of Archie's. A photograph taken by Nan on a golf course in 1926 shows George with Archie and a slightly defiant-looking Nancy. It seems reasonable to think that there was gossip, which does not necessarily mean there was also a love affair. People are quick to see attraction between others, to scent scandal in the air. and close societies which Sunningdale was thrive on rumour. Yet the fact that Archie chose to buy a house with Agatha at the start of 1926 suggests that he had no serious thought then of leaving her. It would have been insane to move from rented accommodation into that large place with its huge mortgage if he had been planning to get away. Even if the urge to buy had been Agatha's, the Christies had already delayed doing so for a year or more before they took Styles. Perhaps this was due to Archie's friendship with Nancy. Perhaps he was thinking of her when he trod the Wentworth estate with Agatha, pretending to plan a new home. That is pure conjecture, though. What is certain is that it would have been easy to wait a little longer to stay at Scotswood until Archie had finally made up his mind to leave. More likely, he was attracted to Nancy from the first, and to some unknownable degree, the two became close throughout 1925. Certainly Archie was not happy during the holiday to Cauterets, so he may well have wished himself back on the golf course with another woman. But by 1926, he had taken the view that his responsibilities lay with Agatha and Rosalind. He was prepared to stick with the life he had, possibly with the addition of a mistress on the side. Then, during the summer in London, he grew close enough to Nancy to want to marry her. To that extent, Agatha was right in her analysis of the situation. It is entirely possible that Archie began an affair while Agatha was at Ashfield. It is equally possible that Nancy held out for marriage, in the manner of an Anne Boleyn. But some sort of pressure was brought to bear upon Archie, who was undeniably willing to be pressurized, to make him want to leave his family. The removal of Clara from the scene, which left Agatha with nobody to fight her corner and shame her husband, would have made it easier for Archie to announce his decision. How could Agatha possibly have remained ignorant? Because her intuition was not quick when it came to real life. It worked only in her art. The shock of Archie's betrayal was absolute. That is beyond question. Yet Unfinished Portrait makes clear the changes in her husband, evident since the birth of Rosalind. According to that book, he had become withdrawn, unemotional, cold. Contemptuous of Agatha's eager, childlike ways, which seemed so inappropriate in a grown woman. Controlled to an extent that was worse even than the lack of control she so disliked. Such detachment from his wife might be seen to indicate earlier, less serious affairs, as might the growing obsession with golf, which took Archie so completely away from his wife, and of course the poems in The Road of Dreams. In fact, there is no evidence whatever of Archie's infidelity. But something in Agatha intuited the death of love, the death of the fervent young man who had returned so apparently unchanged from war. "I will always love you more than anything on earth," he had written to her in 1914. "You are so very precious to me that I can't bear to think of you being ill or unhappy or wanting anything you could possibly have. One day, we will have our cottage, which will be heavenly happiness, and we'll never say goodbye again." She had kept these letters, kept them until she died. This was the Archie she had loved, still saw within the man who looked at her with that furtive, shifty-eyed expression, which meant he was about to betray her. He was not just taking away the life she had hoped to have. He was taking everything. The dances at Uggbrook House, the honeymoon night at the Grand Hotel in Torquay, the wartime fear and passion, the foolish things they had written. Cue for the quarrels that end so demurely, each apology binds them together securely. She knew, of course, that they had not been in love with each other for some time now. But in her obtuse and childlike way, she did not grasp the reality. Her vision of Archie was so deeply fixed in her imagination that she did not see how incomplete it was. The beautiful soldier Lancelot, bruised and bronzed, with his air of romance and fragility, was no more than a man. Like Elaine, Agatha had lived in fantasy, having spent 6 years dreaming an illusory Archie into solid life. She had played with complete sincerity at being a wife. She had lovingly cooked food he could not eat, had accompanied him round the world, then had more fun without him, had tried to share his life while failing to understand him. He was vulnerable in ways more complex and more banal than she had realized. The war had left terrible marks. The fear he had felt during Agatha's pregnancy showed his need for undivided love. His nerves were bad, and throughout the 1920s, Agatha had made them worse. Her work as a writer gave her assurance that expressed itself as a kind of excitable talkativeness, unlike her previous quiet serenity. Her enthusiasms for books, music, travel, Devon, were not his. And her growing independence was a threat because it made Archie feel she could do without him. Perhaps Agatha herself sometimes felt this way. Perhaps the problem was that she was a writer and he was not. They'd go on and on and on, probably at Dalton Heath or somewhere like it. Little shivers ran over her. If one could be free, quite free, nothing. No belongings, no houses, no husband or children. Nothing to hold you and tie you and pull at your heart. The desire for freedom was always there, and the prison of Sunningdale had pushed it to a pitch. Archie might have been falling out of love, but he did so partly because he feared Agatha would do so. He saw in her the need for something more than he could give. He had once stretched out his hands to her like a little boy, knowing that she would hold them. Now, she was clothed in the accoutrements of success, and he could no longer reach her. He did not know that she felt the same way about him, that she was chilled to the bone by his self-control, which had grown like a skin over the heart of the man she loved. There was another factor, though, the oldest one in the history of betrayal. The golden green light, the softness in the air. With them came a quickened pulse, a stirring of the blood, a sudden impatience. A girl came through the trees towards him, a girl with pale, gleaming hair and a rose-flushed skin. He thought, how beautiful, how unutterably beautiful. Nancy Neal was beautiful. She did not look at all like Agatha, being dark, with a face full of sweet, seductive curves. But she had what Agatha had once had, and had now lost. "That's what I remember about her," said Sam James's daughter. "As a child, I remember that Nancy was so beautiful." Thus Agatha wrote in her detective novel Sad Cypress of how Eleanor Carlyle is taken away from the man she loves by a young girl, Mary Gerard, whose beauty renders him helpless. "They would have been together here, now," thinks Eleanor, walking side by side, in gentle proprietary pleasure. Happy. Yes, happy together. But for the fatal accident of a girl's wild rose beauty. Left alone in London with this lovely girl, while his wife wept her heart out in Torquay, Archie was unable to resist. Why had Agatha allowed her looks to go, after all? Did she not realize that a man wanted beauty in his wife? And why must she mourn her mother so wildly? Had she not heard him say that he could not bear illness or distress? He simply could not cope with it. Why could she not have remained the girl with whom he had fallen in love? Slim and fair, the steady, smiling presence who made him feel safe. "I miss you more than ever this time, and feel so lost without having you near me." Nancy seemed like everything Agatha had ceased to be. She was lively in a way that did not irritate. She consoled and reassured with a light touch. She played golf. She did not write. She was grown up. She was beautiful. She needed him. She was the wife and the woman Archie wanted. I must in some way have been inadequate to fill Archie's life, wrote Agatha in her autobiography. He must have been ripe for falling in love with someone else, though he perhaps didn't know it himself. Or was it just this particular girl? With love, who knows? There is always illusion, the illusion that makes one person seem more magical than any other in the world. The question is of degree. Is there enough reality within to sustain love when it can no longer feed upon nature's lure, nature's last and most cunning piece of deceit? When Archie no longer felt passion for Agatha, it was just a matter of time before love evaporated. Archie was a good chap, said Agatha's son-in-law, but he could never have imagined two people who were less compatible. And yet, although Agatha knew that Archie was not the man she had believed him to be, he was not Harry Rayburn or Anthony Cade, not Tristan, not Lancelot. She felt for him a passion that refused to die, however much she might wish it to. O lover of mine that I loved, farewell. She simply could not believe that the letters Archie had written to her belonged to another time, a time that was as dead now as her mother. They seemed as real and alive as ever. Never desert me, darling, and always love me. What had that meant when Archie wrote it? Had it meant something then but not now? How could that be? For Agatha, who spent the rest of her life trying to understand what love means, the illusory Archie did not die. He was fixed in her imagination at the very point of his leaving. Had the marriage lasted longer, she herself might have fallen out of love. As it was, she would never do so. A part of her would always be stuck at the moment when she had sat at Ashfield with Clara's things around her and heard Archie's voice telling her that he loved another woman. He loved Celia, I think, for her beauty and her beauty only, says the narrator of Unfinished Portrait. She loved him enduringly and for life. He was, as she once put it, in her blood. Agatha begged Archie to stay, if not for her sake, then for Rosalind's. She was tormented by the thought that she had lost him through her own fault, and she begged for another chance. Knowing that he ought to stay, he gave in. After a couple of weeks at his club, he returned to Styles, and Agatha's heart soared. He had not really meant it. Everything would be all right again. Archie had just been looking for a fling. Hadn't her grandmother always told her what gentlemen were like? Agatha simply had to be more realistic, more adult. She made plans for the future. She would take a house in town to be nearer her husband. She would let Styles, then she would take the holiday that had been deferred. The Pyrenees again, perhaps. They would spend a wonderful Christmas at Abney, where the sight of the stockings, the magnificent table, Rosalind's starlit face, would make Archie realize how much he was abandoning. Madge reassured her. Yes, Archie would get over it. But James Watts never thought he would. Neither did Charlotte Fisher. This quiet, clever girl watched events at Styles, and as she burned in sympathy for her employer, saw how strongly Agatha was behaving with Archie. Her distress made him feel guilty, and guilt made him cruel. She drove him quite mad and filled his head with thoughts of young, fresh, beautiful Nancy. According to the Nan Conn version of events, the Christies rowed continually at the time, and on one occasion Agatha threw a teapot at Archie. But it is hard to see how Nan could have known this. She was not there after all, and the deeply private Agatha would hardly have confessed to such behaviour, particularly as, according to Nan's daughter, she had cast herself as the innocent victim. Far more convincing is Charlotte's testimony, later offered to Rosalind, that Agatha was tearful, depressed, passive to a degree that alarmed Charlotte and played desperately on Archie's nerves. Everybody can't be happy, he said to Agatha. I can't stand not having what I want, and I can't stand not being happy. He had not, perhaps, understood that Agatha would mind so much, he might have believed that her independence would sustain her. She had money, a career, Rosalind, Carlo, Madge. She could travel if she wanted to. She had so much more in life than a husband. That was part of the problem for him, after all, that she had so much else besides him. Yet here she was, white and distraught, as if losing him were a death blow. If only her mother were still alive, then she would have been all right, perhaps. Archie had agreed to try a 3-month reconciliation period. He went away with his wife to the Pyrenees, and although this was even less successful than their last holiday together, Agatha saw it as a sign of his willingness to stay. In fact, being alone with her in France merely underlined for Archie how little suited they were. Slowly, things went worse and worse, she wrote in Unfinished Portrait. If Celia came into a room, Dermot went out of it. She began to be scared of her husband's hatred. She feared he wanted her dead. This, after all, was what happened in her books. Men killed their wives. He must wish her dead, otherwise she wouldn't be afraid. Peter at her heels was like a little woolly lion. Agatha took him everywhere. One day he was knocked down by a car and left stunned and immobile. After a few minutes he came round, but Agatha, gibbering with grief, was unable to take in the fact that he was alive. Archie was theoretically living at home between August and December 1926, but in reality, he was of no fixed abode. He stayed at Styles, he stayed at his club, he visited the James's house at Hurtmore Cottage. Madge James had recently had a baby, so the weekend parties were less social than usual, but if Archie saw Nancy, it would be there, although ostensibly she was simply one of a party. This was important to Archie. He wanted to marry this woman more than ever now, and he wanted no scandal attached to her name. To this end, he intended that she should not be named in a divorce, a piece of middle-class propriety that Agatha despised. She held out. She would not agree to divorce Archie, would not accept that her marriage was over. There was Rosalind to consider, after all. The bond between father and daughter was so strong. "Daddy doesn't like you much," says Judy in Unfinished Portrait, "but he likes me." Yes, he was prepared to leave his daughter as well as his wife. How could it be possible? Agatha clung to the thought that it was not possible, but she was losing her grip upon that belief, upon everything, in fact. She had not written since her mother died. This worried her. She needed to write, needed to finish the mystery of the blue train, especially if she no longer had a husband. Although it was impossible that she should have no husband, that Archie should leave her. Not Archie. "You are much too good for me," he had written to her during the war, "but I will do anything to try and keep your love." So everything would be all right. If only she had Clara to talk to. What would Clara have said? That she had warned her about Archie's ruthlessness, his attractiveness to women? That she had told her not to leave him alone? No, she would not have said those things. She would have looked at Agatha in her luminous way and held her hand as she fell asleep. If only Mummy were there, if only she were at home at Ashfield, with Mummy and Peter, lying on the grass beneath the beech tree, dreaming stories into life. It was the night of 3rd of December 1926. Agatha sat inside Styles as the house grew dark. She was waiting for Archie to come home. They were going to spend a weekend away together in Yorkshire. "We shall meet again soon, but till then, we will be happy, eat, smile, and grow very fat. I have your photograph to look at, letters to read. I know that you love me almost as much as I love you, and nothing else matters." Rosalind was in bed, Carlo in London. Peter slept calmly. The servants whispered in the shadows. If he did not come home tonight, if instead he went to Godalming, he was never coming home again. The words of Elaine, "Sweet is true love, though given in vain, and sweet is death who puts an end to pain." I know not which is sweeter. No, not I.